Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Stop, start, delay. Is Obamacare ready for us to click? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. And this is your Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, November 27th. Thanks so much for joining us. Maybe you're traveling home for Thanksgiving right now. And if you're the kind of person who talks policy around the table, have at it. There's one more delay for the healthcare law. The Obama administration says that an online marketplace for small businesses to buy coverage will be delayed till next November. Dan Gorenstein covers healthcare for us and joins me now from the health desk at WHYY. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
So put this delay in some perspective for me. How big of a deal is this?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, really, at the end of the day, small businesses are going to still be able to use the shopping qualities, sort of checking the prices, if you will, of the different insurance policies that are offered to companies with 50 employees or fewer. But they're not going to be able to actually enroll online. They're going to have to either use paper applications or use a broker. Many of them already have relationships with brokers. I don't think this is seen as the hugest deal other than the fact that it's yet another delay from the ACA.
So then why'd they do it?
Well, the reason they did it is because of capacity. You know, they're trying to prioritize things. They only have so much that they can do. So the shop exchanges are a lower priority, frankly, than making sure that consumers can go online and use healthcare.gov and make sure that healthcare.gov is going to work for regular consumers.
We are only a couple of days away from November 30th. That's the day that the government has said, okay, we can handle 50,000 people on the website trying to sign up. Can they?
That's the question that everybody is asking. I mean, if you listen to CMS and other healthcare officials in the federal government, the answer is yes, that they can do that. They're going to be able to handle up to 800,000 visitors a day. That said, news is coming out this week that the Obama administration has asked certain partners to downplay aggressive pitches, sending consumers to healthcare.gov, afraid that that could crash the site. So I think people feel like the site is up and running, but it's just got its training wheels off, and so they don't want to push it too hard, too fast.
This is still the side that the consumers see, that folks trying to sign up for insurance see. The other side that the insurers get, the back end, is still really complicated. Can you explain whether there's been any progress made on that end?
Well, in a conference call with reporters today, CMS said that they are still working on hardware issues, software issues, that they're constantly making changes and striving to improve this so-called back end so that basically insurers are able to get the information. I mean, one quote that stands out for me this week is from an insurer saying, we're concerned that somebody on January 1st or January 2nd goes into the doctor's office and there's no indication that these people actually have signed up for insurance. And so that leaves just a lot of mass confusion for doctors, for hospitals, obviously, and fear for the patients. And, you know, at this point, only time will tell. The government is still reluctant to offer any hard data on how much improvement there's been on the backside.
While all that's going on, they're looking for a new boss. Jeff Zients, right, who's the guy who stepped in to run this, is leaving. He's going to be helming a lot of the president's economic policy. So what kind of a candidate would step in and run this thing?
You need somebody with a diverse set of skills. You need someone who understands tech and who understands both the public sector, the private sector. You really need, Lizzie, somebody who understands the insurance industry. It's not going to be easy to find, but some people I've spoken to have said they expect it's probably going to be some sort of insider who understands both the tech world, healthcare, and has the trust of the president.
Dan Gorenstein, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We're going to dig deeper into politics now. If you paid attention in the last election, and I mean any attention, you cannot have missed the work of what are called social welfare organizations. They're called 501c4 groups. They're named after a part of the tax code. They put big money into politics and can keep their donors secret. But new rules from the IRS might limit political campaigning with this so-called dark money. Marketplace's Mark Garrison looks at how that money could get into politics anyway with the help of someone who's very much at home in the dark.
We don't want to pick on either party, so let's use a fictional character, a fan of dark money. Yep, we're dragging out the organ and Count Dracula. You're welcome. Feel free to imagine him as Democrat or Republican, as fits your own bias. Let's say the Count is American and has been quietly funding a 501c4, helping politicians who support tax breaks for FANG maintenance and, I don't know, tariffs on garlic. If these new rules happen, he could try a super PAC.
I would expect that they might be a more popular target for big donors who don't fear media scrutiny.
Sheila Krumholz is with the Center for Responsive Politics. Super PACs disclose donors, which is fine if you're Sheldon Adelson or George Soros, billionaires publicly spending big on both sides. But vampires, not big on daylight. UC Irvine election law professor Rick Hassan says donors would look for other ways to give secretly.
One possibility is that the activity will just shift to C6 trade organizations, even C19 veterans organizations.
501c19? I'll be honest, I had to look that one up. It sounds pretty far-fetched, political operatives using some VFW post.
Well, a few years ago, nobody thought you could use a 501c4 in a campaign context, and so it's possible that you could try to use another one of these organizations.
Count Dracula could also form an LLC, which might allow him to secretly fund a political group. Veteran election lawyer Ken Gross says donations have always gotten around new rules.
Money will find its way into the system one way or the other.
But let's not say Dracula's bad because he wants to give anonymously. He may have good reasons. Bradley Smith is a former Federal Election Commission chair who now chairs a group skeptical of campaign finance regulations.
It's a bad thing to get carried away and make it hard for people to engage in political speech.
These rules are a proposal. The battle over them could last long enough to try the patience even of the undead. That's actually Dracula's election lawyer. A complicated fight is great for the legal business. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, major happy music time. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Car-sharing services like Uber have caught on fast in techie places like San Francisco. You can order up a car right from your smartphone, but it's slower and more alien elsewhere. Uber launched recently in Los Angeles, and that means these are tough times to be a cab driver in a city where cabs are not exactly a way of life. As KPCC's Ben Bergman reports, traditional taxis aren't going down without a fight.
Imagine 60-hour work weeks, waking up at 3 a.m. to spend your whole day navigating L.A. traffic, hoping to make $150 tops. That's what Frances Nazarian does. She's driven a cab for over a decade. She needs the money to help put her youngest daughter through Princeton. She says she has the best job in the world.
I've had days where I'm like, I think I'm on candid camera because everybody who gets in my cab is going, you know, on an $80, $100 ride.
As she drives me down the freeway in her yellow minivan, I get the sense Nazarian might be the most cheerful cabbie I've ever met. But then I ask her what she thinks about ride-sharing services.
Well, obviously, I think they suck.
Nazarian says in her house, Uber has become a four-letter word.
I know my sister called me and she's like, oh, have you heard of Uber? I'm like, your sister drives a taxi and you're calling me and saying how great Uber is. Would you just shut up?
Nazarian says business is slower since ride-sharing came to town, but that's not what bothers her. It's the unfair competition. The likes of Uber don't have nearly as many regulatory hoops to jump through. Unlike taxis, they can raise their prices during peak times, and they can pick and choose which rides they accept and which neighborhoods they go to.
I guarantee you, I could get on the Uber app right now and call from where we are right now, South Central, and not one Uber driver would take that call, or Lyft, or a sidecar. Basically, they want to work in the most affluent areas of town.
Uber has been advertising for drivers in L.A., promising they can make up to $60,000 a year. That's twice what Nazarian brings home. So would she ever consider switching over?
Oh, no, I'm happy where I'm at. I'm so content with what I do.
But the taxi industry isn't so content. Ridership has been declining all over the country, anywhere from 10 to 30% in cities where services like Uber have entered the market. Yellow Cab of Los Angeles, by far the city's largest taxi company, has 15% fewer calls coming in. That's after 4 years of double-digit growth.
Does that mean we're in dire straits? Absolutely not. But it is a cause for concern. We watch trends just like everybody else.
William Rouse just ended his term as head of the National Trade Association that represents taxis. He's also general manager of Yellow Cab of LA.
This organization, in one form or another, is an outgrowth of my family's business. And we've operated every hour of every day since 1937.
When Uber came to town last year, Rouse focused his attention on trying to convince regulators to ban ride-sharing, what he calls bandit taxis. It didn't work. California became the first state to regulate the services in September. With few legal options left, Rouse has now turned his focus inward.
We're committed to problem solving, improving the product, and then going out and marketing like we never have before in order to rebuild the business.
A quarter of Yellow Cab's calls now come from a sleek mobile app that looks suspiciously like Uber's. But not all drivers are allowed to pick up customers who use the app. First, they have to go through classes to improve customer service skills. It seems to be a direct response to the perception that get in a taxi and you'll be met by a scowl. Ride Uber and the driver will ask you what you want on the radio and hand you a chilled bottle of water. As difficult as it is for him to admit, Rouse says ride-sharing is making taxis better.
I'm not going to go and say that companies that come in and break the law have helped us. At the same time, it is a good thing for companies to peel back the onion, look at their product, and improve their product.
So would Rouse ever consider riding Uber, even just to better know what he's up against? He says he came close when he was away on a business trip recently. Then he decided he'd better stick with the taxi. In Los Angeles, I'm Ben Bergman for Marketplace.
If you're going to the movies this week or weekend, maybe you're part of the mass of humanity lining up for Catching Fire, the second Hunger Games movie. It opened last Friday, earning almost $160 million that weekend, a record for a November release, and adults are lining up to see the movie, right next to teenage fans, including one adult on our staff, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer, who explains this phenomenon.
Okay, let's just get this right on the table. I'm one of those adults who loves young adult fare. I read the Harry Potter books and the Hunger Games series, saw the movies, and loved every minute of them. But why? Tom Adams thinks he knows.
Grown-ups want to be kids.
Adams is U.S. Media Research Director for IHS. He read the Harry Potter books with his kids, saw those movies, and the first Hunger Games movie.
One of the greatest ways to forget that you're a 55-year-old is to go into a dark movie theater and have an amazing story about young adults told.
This is the 75th year of the Hunger Games.
David Levithan is vice president, publisher, and editorial director of Scholastic. He published the Hunger Games books. The books focus on struggles against depression, a very adult theme. Levithan says there's another reason for the adult appeal of the Hunger Games and Harry Potter movies. They used big, older stars.
Once the franchise established themselves, they knew that they could get incredible talent, which does have appeal both to the teens and the adults.
But Levithan says these movies are firmly marketed at the teen audience. They just happen to appeal to adults, too. Same with the books. Elizabeth Chandler is co-founder of Goodreads.com. She followed the progress of the Hunger Games series.
We notice that the same number of 32-year-olds are reading the book as the number of 15-year-olds.
Chandler says it boils down to this. Whether you're talking about Hunger Games, the Twilight series, which was very popular with women, or Harry Potter, if it's a great, gut-wrenching story, people will read it.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
Yes, Harry, you are a wizard for people of all ages. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
if anybody says that they know why I'm always really popular, they're probably making it up.
How a red ball of fuzz came to dominate Black Friday. But first, let's do the numbers. Shares rose today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 24 points, a tenth percent, to close at 16,097. The NASDAQ was up 27 points, two-thirds percent, to end at 4044. The S&P 500 rose 4 points, a quarter percent, to finish the day at 1807. Tech took off. Computer giant Hewlett-Packard clipped up 9% a day after announcing better-than-expected quarterly results. Apple advanced 2 1/3%, and IBM inched up 0.9%. Energy shares ran out of steam as U.S. crude oil inventories increased. Newfield Exploration drilled down 4%. Noble Energy slid 4.5%. In Europe, markets rose. Germany's DAX advanced 0.2%. Britain's FTSE was up 0.2%. France's CAC 40 ended 0.3% higher. In Asia, the Nikkei nudged down 0.4%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. U.S. markets are closed. The Capitol is pretty much closed. Banks and post offices are closed. But some stores are open, luring customers to those great deals early. And think you're a descendant of the Plymouth colonists, those who sat at one of the first Thanksgivings? The Census Bureau says there were 25.3 million U.S. residents of English ancestry as of 2012. Sounds like an opportunity for some old family recipes. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in all week for Kai Rizdahl. It's been almost 2 months since the Obamacare health exchanges opened, and as we said at the top of the show, it hasn't been the smoothest rollout in American history. But it's not like something of this scale has never been tried. There's precedent. Two examples, when Social Security and Medicare launched. Craig Lamolt from WSHU has our story about what's so different this time.
How do you sign up tens of millions of people for one program, and with no website to log on to? Well, for Social Security, they turned to the good old Postal Service.
In Washington, out go letters. In come applications as eager oldsters sign up to help save their country and to obtain steady incomes for themselves.
When the government started signing people up for Social Security, they invented a whole new system to identify all of us, the Social Security number. Everyone's information was stored in a cavernous warehouse in Baltimore.
They had millions and millions of pieces of paper and numbers that they had to keep track of, but they had people who could do it.
Ed Berkowitz is a history professor at George Washington University.
I don't think we quite have that luxury today in terms of manpower because the government is very constrained in its operations.
Also, it was easier to identify everyone who was over 65. With healthcare today, it's tricky to figure out which Americans don't have insurance. For Social Security, you didn't get a choice. It was law, and you had to sign up. 30 years later, signing people up for Medicare was a little more complicated, but still way simpler than Obamacare is. Ted Marmor is an emeritus professor at Yale who was part of the government team that rolled out Medicare.
It's easy to make the case to an older American in 1966, you know what? You've got hospital insurance now that you've already paid for. And this is going to be done under the auspices of the Social Security Administration, in which there was considerable public trust.
The Social Security Administration used the whole apparatus they'd built over the previous 30 years to construct the new Medicare program. There were leaders who were experienced, everybody knew what their job was, and Marmor says there was a clear chain of command.
Now, just contrast that with the apparatus since March of 2010 and now. Do you have any comparable sense of that? No, you don't, because it isn't here.
During the Medicare rollout, there were Social Security offices all over the country that people could just walk into and ask a question. We actually do have something like that today. Problem is, there's just two, and they're both in Connecticut.
So you came in to start doing the application?
Yeah, application.
Officials at the Connecticut Healthcare Exchange say the enrollment centers in New Haven and New Britain are the only storefront locations in the country specifically for helping people enroll in Obamacare. Sure, around the country there are navigators and application counselors, but Ted Marmor says it's not the same as having a well-established location in every town, like the Social Security offices back in the day. For Jermaine Monk, who came to sign up at the New Haven Enrollment Center, the hardest part was creating a password that had enough numbers and symbols to satisfy the state's website.
I think it worked fine. It was fine. It actually didn't take as long as I thought. I thought it would take, like, maybe 4 hours or something.
Of course, it's not as easy other places, especially in states that aren't as on board with the whole exchange thing. Jonathan Oberlander, who's a health policy professor at UNC Chapel Hill, says that's a key difference between the Obamacare rollout and the big ones of yesteryear. Social Security and Medicare were federal programs through and through.
And one of the Achilles heel in Obamacare is that its success depends on the cooperation of states that want the law to fail.
He says as much as the current rollout has been bungled, when you compare it to Social Security and Medicare, this one was just a lot harder from the beginning. In New Haven, I'm Craig LaMolt for Marketplace.
There are a couple holiday news stories that you sort of always hear. Air travel nightmares, fried turkeys that take the house with them, department store Mortal Kombat so that a kid can have that one hot, must-be-gotten toy. For almost 20 years, one of those toys has been a fuzzy, squeaky, red puppet.
Oh, 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 hi! Elmo's so happy to see you!
That's Elmo. Roberto Ferdman is a reporter for Quartz, and he's written what appears to be a definitive history of Elmos. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
The first blockbuster Christmas Elmo was Tickle Me Elmo in 1996, and it's really a story of supply and demand. What happened?
So Tyco, which was making the toys for Sesame Workshop, launched this toy, and it wasn't on any sort of top toy lists or anything like that. But then demand for it just went through the roof. They were off the shelves. They didn't make enough of them. Toy stores didn't put enough of them inside of the stores. And, you know, you can really see how successful it was because the following year, when toy stores put them in the stores, they sold 7 times the amount that they had sold the first year that it was launched. So it's not a bad thing that they did, that they undersupplied the market. You know, people really want it. They can't get it. It makes them want it more.
So what did that do to the toy industry and, I guess, the Elmo industry?
It really started what's been, you know, 18 consecutive years almost of massive Elmo toy sales, especially around the holidays. And the reason that's the case is because toy stores historically now especially tend to be pretty risk averse. They don't want to stock up on toys that they won't be able to get off of their shelves. You know, excess supply is a terrible thing for toy stores. They don't make a lot of money off of these as it is, especially around the holidays when they discount them. So that first year when Elmo was really popular, it allowed toy stores to then stock up on the Elmos going forward, and they've flown off the shelves.
And different companies have owned the licensing rights to Elmo, but they all still seem to cling to this magic that is kids' fascination with this red fuzzy thing.
So it's funny, I spoke to a few people, and I remember one analyst in particular. And he said that if anybody says that they know why Elmo's really popular, they're probably making it up. And it's really hard to pin down what exactly is so fantastic about Elmo in the eyes of preschoolers, effectively, which are, you know, the target demographic for Elmo. And it's actually been a frustration for both Sesame Workshop, or Sesame Street, really, and the toy companies that have made these toys, because Elmo's the only Sesame Street character really that's created its own brand. They've tried to do it with Cookie Monster, but Cookie Monster has not been as successful. Big Bird hasn't. You know, Elmo's really something separate from Sesame Street.
Elmo always ends up on these hot toy lists, right? Who makes these lists?
These lists are often made by stores or sponsored by stores. So this year, Toys R Us has their own list. Target has their own list. And Elmo's on both of these lists, probably because both Toys R Us and Target have a lot of Elmos on their shelves.
So this year's Elmo is?
It's called Big Hugs Elmo. Very friendly, likes to give hugs. But Big Hugs Elmo is also kind of a conglomeration of all the Elmos before it. It's able to sing. It's able to talk. It hugs children. So it does a lot of things that previous Elmos have done, but all together in one package. So one of the things that I heard from the people I spoke with from the toy industry was that in many ways this is the most interactive and maybe the first like truly interactive Elmo.
This is the Elmo, Elmo.
This is the Elmo. This is the Uber Elmo. It may very well be.
Roberto Ferdman from Quartz, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on our show today might be a bit of a worrisome one for sriracha lovers. That, to the uninitiated, is a tasty Asian hot chili sauce made in California. But the plant that makes it outside Los Angeles has been partially shut down under a judge's order. Residents who live near the plant complained of heartburn, asthma, and nosebleeds that they said were caused by the spicy smells coming from the sriracha plant. The city and the plant owner, Haifeng Foods, are trying to come up with a solution that works for the people who live near there and for those who like to buy and eat the spicy red stuff. You can check out an interview with the founder of Sriracha on our website, who tells us why he prices his stuff the way he does. That's at marketplace.org. All right, that's it. That's our show from American Public Media. Carlos Asensio, Robbie Carmen, Chris Clark, Stephen Cologne, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the program for us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we hope you join us back here tomorrow. We will be celebrating Thanksgiving. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.